שלום וברוכים הבאים לרוורסים פלטפורמה. זה לא פרק טיפוסי, אנחנו מקשיבים כעת להקלטה שנערכה בכנס רוורסים 2016 במכון ויצמן. האזנה נעימה.
Hi, welcome to the user research digging for gold talk. I'm Caleb. But first, I want to start it off by saying toda. So toda raba, I think that's it. I might have pronounced that horribly wrong, in which case I'm super sorry. Or slicha. So what I'm going to be talking today is about user research. So this is the kind of the land and how I'll go through it today. I'll first start by doing a brief introduction. I'll talk about the lying liars that are Americans. I'll go in briefly about user research and how it plays a role in the product lifecycle. And then I'll introduce you to the 4Ds, which is my kind of equation for doing user research and specifically doing interviews with clients. And then at the very end, I'll leave time for questions. So if you can, try to hold your questions to the very end so that I can get through everything. Cool. So as I said before, Shalom, I am Caleb, Ani Caleb. I am a user researcher, designer, and strategist at Kenshu, a lovely supporter here of the event. So basically what that means is I get to talk to people all day, I get to pick their brain, and then I try to formulate those things, those insights, into something that's more actionable for the teams all over the world. So customer success or customer service, support, whatever you name it, and then ideally developers and engineers and PMs. So I think it's pretty evident, but I'm an American. And if you Google search American tourist, this comes up. Evidently, we like the American flag and sequins and fanny packs. And so if you combine them together, it's really amazing. And as I said before, I'm also an American liar. All Americans will lie to you, and I'll go through this in great detail. But I do not support Trump. But what we'll talk about first is a little bit about myself. So I believe that we're somewhere in this green mass. I can't really figure it out, but that's where we're at. And I grew up very far from here. So I grew up about 12,000 kilometers away. I currently live in San Francisco, but 12,000 kilometers away in the bustling state of Indiana, which is somewhere in the middle. It's okay. I won't quiz you later. And then a small town called Chalmers. It's about the size of your kibbutzes, or moeshavs, is that right? I don't know. But basically, it's about 300 people. It's a very small town. And I specifically grew up right there. That's my home in that small town. And so why is this important? Why does it make me an expert at lying, more or less? So if you've ever been to the Midwest, a lot of people will say, everybody is so nice. Everybody's so polite here. Like, you're like, oh, can you get directions? Oh, yeah, honey, sweetheart, it's right over there. What they don't tell you is that the nice is kind of in quote marks. It's Midwestern nice, you know? And it may seem familiar because they'll come up and they'll talk to you and be like, oh, hi, Janice, how are you? Oh, so lovely to see you again. Can you believe what she's wearing? I can't believe it. Or the most is like, can you believe what she brought to dinner? Disgusting. So I grew up in that environment and playing nice all the time. And why I left was kind of because of that niceness. That and everybody's in your business 24/7. But I'm not alone. Americans themselves lie a lot. There was a study done back in 2002 that said 60% actually of Americans lie. Furthermore, 54% are actually pretty accurate at telling whether or not a person is good at lying. But in the first 10 minutes of meeting a complete stranger. You have nothing on the line, but yet you're going to lie to them. And even then, and like worse, it's three times. I'm going to lie to you three times to your face within the first 10 minutes. Many of them are small lies, unless you're Donald Trump, in which case they might be big. What's also interesting, I love this little survey, because what they did in this study is they found out what the worst lies were and then what the minor lies. If you'll notice, there's a theme on the worst lies. Evidently, Americans like to lie about sex. Some of the minor lies are kind of what you would expect. I am particularly an offender of the second one. I am not really bad with names. I just don't remember yours. And it's even harder here because you have some difficult names for me to pronounce. But basically, what happens with Americans and their lying is that it doesn't really end there. In a separate study that was done by Michigan State University, they asked people on a survey if they'd actually lied during the survey, of which 4% said they did. Really? Really, guy? Yeah, so we're all liars, Americans in particular, but I think that we're all in the same boat. We've all lied at one point or another, and if that's not the truth, you try to answer that question. I think that you've probably lied a time or two when you've been presented with that, or you narrowly escaped with your life. So the really crux to it is why we lie. First, to understand how we can get the truth, we need to understand where is this lying coming from. And in particular for Americans, it's a lot about politeness. And that's kind of what I grew up on in the Midwest, is you never really speak your mind because your mind is a dangerous place full of quagmires and you don't want to say anything. So I will be polite. And politeness is valued more than honesty. The second reason, really, is self-preservation. And I'm sure that everybody in the room has done this a time or two. Like, think back to your teenage years where you were probably dating somebody, maybe not, or escaping out of your house in the wee hours. That's for self-preservation, when you lie to your parents and said, no, I didn't have people over at all. Not one bit. I totally had people over, and we had fun. So that's kind of the self-preservation. It's ingrained in us because you never want to be wrong, you don't want to appear stupid, and you never want to be at fault. So that looks pretty bad, right? You're probably sitting here thinking, okay, everybody lies, Americans in particular, so what am I going to do? I'm shipping a product to the States. I'm tasked with trying to figure out what's happening and understanding insights for my clients. And then you're like, what am I going to do? Well, that's where I come in. Or you can do it. So there's user research. And really what user research is, clinically by definition, is systematic inquiry and observation to test assumptions and reduce the overall risk of failure. And I say risk with a dollar sign here because it's really about cost, right? Like, to build a product is very costly. And you want to remove as much doubt and assumptions and risk as possible. And that's where user research can kind of help you. So what brought me to user research is this. It's more about being right more than you are wrong. You know, people will say fail fast, build, measure, learn, and then keep going. But user research really can help you, if you do it at the beginning, to significantly reduce the risk of failure. And this is all about avoiding the fadiga. This was introduced to me very early when I got to Israel. People were like, oh, you know, it was a total fadiga. And I was like, yeah, kind of like that. There are twin brothers that work at Kenshu, and I mistakenly said, oh, hi, one lives in the U.S., one lives here. And I was like, oh, go, not go. That was the fadiga. But one of the biggest lies that we tell ourselves in software and tech is this creepy little lie, if you build it, they will come. No, not quite. It doesn't really work like that. And if you build product, you know it, because you're like, oh, we built this awesome thing. Why is nobody using it? Well, they didn't see the value in it. And then that's where user research really could have helped out. And that's why I actually got into user research in the beginning. I was a PM for 8 years, and then I said, screw this. I want to go back and be a user researcher and designer because I loved being right. And I'm sure every Israeli in the room can probably attest to that, because if there's one thing that I know about Israelis is that they really like to argue, which means that they really like to be right. But what user research is not, is it's not asking what you want or what you like or what you think you would like. That is not user research. You're really just asking for opinions there. And it's not going to do you any favors by asking those questions. So Erica Hall, who is really a UX guru, she's an awesome researcher, written a couple of books, done presentations galore. If you look her up, you'll love her. But she basically quoted this. She's like, you don't make money off of what people will do or what people say they will do. You actually make money off of what they'll do. Because people like to talk the talk, but they don't really walk the walk. So what user research is meant to do is really uncover that. It's meant to minimize risk, maximize value, and then uncover the truth behind the product, the motivations of your users, and more importantly, why they're going to actually even use your product, if they're going to use your product. So the way that I do this is through the 4 Ds. I've tried to make it very easy. It would probably be easier if it was in Hebrew. But it's overall define, disarm, decipher, and data. So those are the 4 Ds. I'll go through them in much bigger detail here shortly. So let's start with define. So there's a really awesome quote by Dwight D. Eisenhower that basically says, in preparing for battle, I have found that plans are useless, but the art of planning and preparation is indispensable. And that's so true. If there's one thing that you take away from this, I hope it's this section, because it is a lot of preparation, and you'll feel so much better and you'll uncover more truths if you prepare. And what planning looks like for me at Kenshu and other places, if you work with a UX research team, they'll probably take you through this because it's fairly much the same. So the first part that you'll kind of start at is finding who your target persona is. Like, who are your users? Are they single moms? Are they sporty moms? Are they, you know, desperate dads trying to find daycare? Like, who are your target market? And really clearly define that, because those are the people that you're going to want to interview. The next will be looking at success metrics. So what does success look like for your product? So imagine a sunny day scenario, your product's launched out into market, and is it really making a lot of money? Well, yeah, probably. But behind that, you need people to use your product first to make the money. So is it app downloads? Is it clicks, logins? Like, what are you exactly measuring? And that will help define your kind of roadmap. The next thing, and it kind of goes without saying, is your competitors. But what's cool about user research is while people, like, you're in the session, you could maybe hint at some competitors, and you could possibly even see some of your competitors' information and data and how they're using the platform. So this is, you know, critical, but you probably know a lot about your competitors, but if you have a particular feature that you want to drill into, this is like where you should state it and kind of get your head around it. The next thing is looking at assumptions, and this is big, because as you can imagine from my definition, it's about testing assumptions. So there's a lot of work in preparation to understanding the assumptions. And then the last part is a discussion guide. And I'm going to pick the last two because I think they're critically important to go in a little bit more about what we do at Kenshu and how we're tackling these two specific issues. So, assumptions. So, in the U.S., I don't know if you know this term, but it's a colloquialism that you say, which is basically when you assume, you make an ass out of you and me. And that's very true. But basically, it's what you think you know about your users, about your competitors, about your market, and then what is the risk associated with that? So what I do is I gather all the people in the room, typically. There's a PM, there's engineers, anybody who's on the project team that's really close to it. Another awesome person that you should get in the room is your customer success or customer support. You know, whoever is directly interfacing with the customer, they're awesome at this. And then you write down all of your assumptions as a team. Do you assume that they need a particular feature? Do you assume that they're logging in? What do you assume about your competitors? Do you assume that they're not seeing your data or they're not doing this? So you write these down on post-it notes. And then because I'm a designer, I like to stick things on walls. So I put one axis, and this is your risk. So it's everywhere from your low-risk items, which are like no big deal, all the way to your high-risk items, which are your fadijas, your super fadijas. So you're sitting there and you're going, okay, where are they on this matrix? And then you have another axis, which is your level of certainty. You go everywhere from uncertain, like I don't know, to completely certain, somebody has said it once, this one client did it. This is where your customer success or your support people can come in because they can validate that. They can say, actually, no, that's not what they do today because I just got this support ticket from them. They're critical in mapping out these assumptions. And then, unsurprisingly, or maybe it's a surprise, you're focusing in that quadrant for user research. So you're saying, okay, let's take everything that's super uncertain, everything that's super high risk, and we're just going to go research it. And this is great at the beginning of a product because now you know. Like you're informing yourself before you involve design, before you involve coders or even the QA team. Like you have this evidence before you go into it. So the next one is defining your questions. And this is super critical. If you've ever taken a survey or have ever actually done survey design, there's a lot of emphasis on questions. And that's because it unknowingly introduces bias. And bias is bad. Bias is evil. So you want to define your questions up front in this discussion guide. It doesn't have to be long. It's just to start you thinking about those questions and prepare you for battle when you go into an interview. So what are some golden nuggets for really good questions? One, do not lead the witness. It's a legal term, but I'm pretty sure you all know what I mean. You also want to ask open-ended questions. Asking a yes-no question is not really going to get you anything. It's like, okay, right, yes, okay. Okay, what do you mean by that? Follow up with why and how a lot. There's a thing called the five whys. You really just ask why five times. But it's really great because you can get to the root of the matter with people. There are no hypotheticals or conditionals. This is your should, could, would, might. These are hypotheticals, which are really good for envisioning the future of things, but not indicative of whether or not somebody's actually going to do anything. So that's why I say stay away from them. And that leads into the last one, which is really do task-based questions. So if you're coming up with a feature, like a reporting request or something, like something in reporting or data visualization, ask them to do what they're doing today. They're looking at it today. Even if you were get taxi or Uber, people were hailing cars. Like, it's nothing new. Just say, okay, how do you do it? Is it like in the movies where you stand on the corner and you whistle really loud? Well, what about if you're a person you can't whistle, like me? What do you do? So when you go through this, let's go through the first one. So as I said before, bias is bad. So you don't want to introduce it into your your user research at all? Oh, well played, sir. So when you're looking at questions, there's some good, there's some bad, there's some better. And so I'll go through them a little bit more. Here's some more examples. One is which we just did. But overall, what you're trying to find, and this is a good rule of thumb, is you're trying to switch to do's. And like I said before, that's the heart of user research. It's not what they think or in this imaginary land that they think that they'll do something in a good light. What are they actually doing today? Because current behavior is a super good predictor for future behavior. So that's questions. That's the series of define. And here are some of my favorite questions. If you would like to use them, you can notice them. You'll probably use these on your own, or if you have a user research team, they do this a lot. The two questions that are particularly interesting are the ones of, what do you love about the product slash process? Didn't he just say, don't introduce bias? Isn't love really biased? It is, but if you do slip up and you do ask a positive trending question like that, ask the negative trending question. So you ask the opposite of it. So that's the, how could this be better about what you did today? Like, how could this be better? Great. If I ask like, I ask, okay, what do you not like? That's a way to get around it if you do slip up, which you do all the time. I do it all the time. So the last one is really awesome, and I hope that you use this question, but it mostly comes at the end of an interview, and you'll say, is there any other questions that I should be asking? And so this, you're empowering the user that you're interviewing or the interviewee. You're empowering them. You're making them feel like an expert, which everybody loves. And then you're also getting some really good gold nuggets about what you should be asking for future interviews. So if you have a slew of interviews that day or that week, this one will help kind of guide you along your way. So that's the questions. But bottom line about research, it's and preparing and planning, garbage in is garbage out. So if you don't do any planning, you're not going to have a very good research at the end of the day. And I hope that you do planning. But like Dwight D. Eisenhower said at the beginning, invariably, these things will not go to plan. But the fact that you actually planned means that you're better prepared for when it doesn't go to plan. So the next one is disarming your interviewee. And this is a lot of body language. It's a lot of talking about things and really reading context clues of your users and then trying to put them at ease. So the first thing that we do in interviewing is really, like I said before, you put them at ease. That's the number one rule. Then you go in and you want to set the scene. Tell them why they're there today. Do it in a little bit greater detail. And then you do the expert. You make them feel as if they're the expert. They're the tutor. You're the pupil. And then the last one is be neutral. And again, your body betrays you. So just as their body is going to betray them, your body is going to betray you. So I'll talk about these really briefly in total. So the put people at ease. What this really looks like is immediately when you meet somebody, and you probably already know this, but it's all about the first impression. It's really going to make or break the interview for the particular person and whether or not it's going to be easy for you to get the truth out of them or it's going to be difficult. So the way that you do this is by being polite. Politeness is the enemy for lies, but it's really good for you. So you be polite, you make eye contact. Another neuroscience hack is body language. So if somebody is particularly closed off, whenever you meet somebody, you immediately in those first pivotal minutes, you're trying to figure out, and your brain is trying to figure out, if this person is evil or if this person is good. And so that's the fight or flight response that you'll probably hear of. I have a little bit of a nervous fight or flight right now, like my hands are super sweaty. But the way that you get around this with your users, and this is totally tricky, but it's awesome and it totally works, is that when you first meet them, you come up on stage or you talk to them like in the room and you shake their hand, but my eyebrows are lifted. So that sends a subconscious message to the user that you're not a threat. That'll put them at ease and they're going to be more willing to share. The other thing is to show your hands, and specifically your palms. And this is another hack where this is a vulnerability signal. I don't know if you know where the handshake comes from, but the handshake originally was giving your palm to the other person. So it was an act of vulnerability, like showing that you're meeting them on level ground. Well, oddly, if you show your hands to people, they will also start to retreat a little bit. Like, if they're on the defensive at that time, you just be like, whoa, 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 whoa. Well, there's a reason why you show your hands, because unknowingly, it will start to back them off, unless they're super aggressive. Well, then that might not work. So the next thing is setting the scene. In this first 5 minutes, it's really about just welcoming them there, telling them why they're there, and specifically set some ground rules of engagement. Like, what are you hoping to achieve through this session? What they can expect through the session? So the more that they feel comfortable and they know what's coming at them, they'll do it. And I forgot my animation. So it really looks like that. But the last two are the most critical. You tell them that there are no right or wrong answers, and that they can say whatever. It's a safe place. And you want to tell them that again. So usually when I invite them in, I say, hey, welcome. I just want to start off by saying we're not testing you today. There are no right or wrong answers. Whatever you say is totally good. The important thing is being honest. And then I say it again in the middle, and I say again at the end. And I often will remind people in the interview because I see that they're not being truthful. They're the expert. This should go without saying, but really treat them as if they're the expert. Don't judge them. A tricky thing is when they'll ask you questions, and most often they will. They'll say, does this do that? Does that do that? And true to your unbiasedness, you'll say, I don't know. I'm not really supposed to answer any questions because that might introduce bias, but what do you expect would happen? And then that way, you're getting around the bias that you would have introduced if you answered the question. So try not to answer them. Just tell them that you're going to answer them at the end. And so the next thing that you do after that is be neutral. So again, this whole bias theme is throughout. But you don't say yes if they do something. That's a clear indicator that you wanted that to happen. You don't say no. Oh, shit. Yeah, you might want to go. Like, you don't do that. So you need to mind your body language and stay completely neutral as possible. And if you see people at, like, there are, like, videos of people at Google doing this, they're really interesting because they're, like, stone-faced. They're like, mm-hmm. I'm not that good, but obviously I'm a little out there. So the next one is decipher. This is the third D, if you've been counting. And Malcolm Gladwell is awesome. He has an amazing podcast I think that you should listen to called Revisionist History. I don't work for him, but I just plugged him. But he talks about the unspoken, and he interviews people a lot, and he really gets to the nut of the issue or the crux of it. And there's two things that you should really look for in the unspoken. And these things are a little bit more advanced. They're more finesse. But you're looking for the unspoken, and you're listening for the unspoken. So the first one is looking for the unspoken. Is why, this is a little bit tricky, but it's body language again, or somatic language, where your body will give you away. It will betray you if you know how to read it. So basically, it's like crossed arms, crossed legs. If they're tilted to the side, that kind of means that they're off. They're not guarded. Because if I was open, I would be like this. Yeah, ask me questions. What do you want? The last two are really super interesting, and I'll give you them. More sciencey stuff that I love, called microexpressions and then eye positions. So as much as we'd love to be the animated character in the back, yeah, most people are not like that. Lucky if you are, because they'd be fun people to be around. So micro-expressions, if you've seen the show Lie to Me, Lie to Me is all about this. So that guy is up there reading people's micro-expressions. They're a fleeting expression, but they're true. It's a true source of emotion. So there are studies done. Dr. Paul Ekman did studies back way back when. And he basically said that there are micro-expressions that people give off, and they relate to 7 different emotions. I don't know why they picked 7, but it's pretty much anger, fear, disgust, sadness, happiness. Surprise is one of them, and I'm missing one. But there are 2 that I'll kind of go into further detail. But the tricky part about micro-expressions is they truly are micro. They happen in a 25th to a 15th of a second. So I don't expect that you will master this, but it's good to be aware of because then you can keep your eye out. So I'll show you one. What do you think this is? Out of those 7 kind of, well, I, what? Yes, you are good. Yes. So it's down and together, the glare, it's fairly obvious, but usually in the micro-expression, again, they'll just be like that, and then it's done. And if you didn't catch it, or if they were looking at a screen, this is where it's always great to be facing the person so that you can catch these. So there's another one. So there's the neutral face on the left, your left. And then here is the micro-expression. Belief, not. What? Yes. That is very good. It is contempt. So basically, what happens is that when you're angry and you're repeatedly angry, you will then reach contempt, which means that you piss them off and you have to do something to like backtrack it. Usually, this happens in an interview. I've seen it every single time. When somebody asks a loaded question or a judging question, like, wouldn't you rather do this? Wouldn't you do it this way? That's judging. And you don't want to do that because it will quickly lead to anger and contempt. The next thing that you should look for is eye movement. So when you're looking at the eyes, there's a recent study that talked about this in further detail. But basically, on the left side, I'm being more truthful. This is all about remembrance, and so if I look to the upper left, I'll visually recall something. If I look towards my ear, then that means that I'm trying to listen. I'm trying to hear what I heard before. And then if I look down below, that means that I'm talking to myself. So I'm like listening to my inner dialogue of like, should I say that? Should I not say that? Like, I don't know if I should. And then, conversely, on the other side, if I look to the right side, that's more of an indication that I'm lying or I'm constructing something. And so I say that construction because it really is that. If you ask a hypothetical question, they're probably going to look over here because they're trying to construct a make-believe. But if you see that, then you should go for the do answer. Like, you should go for the do question where you're like, what do you do today? What do you, like, you woke up this morning, what did you do immediately? So the next one is listening for the unspoken. And these are just red flags. If you hear these in an interview, your job is to follow up with some hows, whys, all of that. So if they say, especially Americans, if they sound angry, amplify that by 10. Because we like to understate stuff and we like to be polite. And so normally if they get angry, that means it's really bad. Like they're on the edge of blowing. So I think, I feel, I believe, I'm not paying you for that. You're not going to pay me for that. So it's all about doing. Interesting is not interesting. It's me trying to cover up the fact that you just said something that I can't say, oh, I hate that. So if you say interesting, it's usually, oh, is that a good interesting or is that a bad interesting? And then they will follow in some direction, but they'll probably undercut it a little bit. The other thing is qualifying language. This is much a textbook lying thing. But if I use qualifiers like most of the time, well, Why is it only most of the time? If you were assertive, you would say all of the time. But if you couch things in different qualifying terms, that's a red flag. And so you say, okay, what do you do the other times? Or you said most of the time, like, how often is that? Like 7 out of 10? Like 2 out of 10? And then the other thing is elongation of words. And men particularly, like this is kind of a sexist thing, but they'll say, oh, that's great. That's not great. If it takes too many syllables, it's not a good idea. So the last part is data. W. Deming said this, and I love this quote, but basically he also said this quote along with another one that was, if you don't have data, it's just opinions. And it's true that you do qualitative, which is user research, and then you complement it with data, which is quantitative. So in your attack, anything that they say that's in the user interview, if it's kind of a flag or you're like, I don't really believe them, try to see if you can back it up with data. So look at server logs, look at web analytics, whatever you got in the bag is great. One thing that we've done at Kenshu, which I love doing with the product team, is this last exercise that's post-interview surveys on priority. So instead of doing a poker chip game in front of them on priority, which is all fun, but it's more of a game, and because you're there, they're going to lie to you, or they might like sense, based upon your questions, what is the preferred priority. Well, if you do this afterwards, they'll be more truthful. And the way that it came up at Kenshu was we did export to PDF or export to XLS. Everybody was saying export to PDF. I don't know why. I was like, why are, okay. And I was like, they really like PDFs. That's great. My customer success team came to me and they said, no, they don't mean that. They're lying to you. And I was like, okay. Like, and they're like, no, they want XLS. So we sent them in the survey afterwards, a survey. So we said, okay, here's 22 features that we talked about. Here's some new features that we're thinking about. You rate them based upon what you want to see us build next. And what was interesting is that export to XLS was number 2. And that was super interesting because when we asked them about export to PDF, it was way down at the bottom. Like out of 22 features, it was 21. And if I would have built export to PDF, what, like, nobody would use it. They would be like, okay, that's great, but I can't copy and paste. And I can't go here and I can't go there. So be careful and try to use data in a great way, like to back up all the research that you're doing in your interviews. So these are my nuggets. One, Americans lie, which you probably already know. User research can help, but it's not going to be your savior. And then my four Ds. So define a plan, which is uber important. Disarm your interviewees through semantic language, reassurance, and then decipher the unspoken and back it all up with data. So that's how I do it. Now you're demystified. You get all my bags. So are there any questions? Sure. Yes. Yeah, so the question, if I hear it right, I'm just going to repeat it. One, so everybody can hear, and two, so that you can keep me honest. So can I talk a little bit about user voice, user testing, like remote testing softwares, and ask about those type of questions and stuff like that that are in the platform? Are you using one today? Oh, okay. Yeah. So that's more like, I would call those greenhouses, where people can put out their ideas, and then there's like user voting. So it kind of does priority testing. taking in feedback like that is always great. I think it's awesome where people can vote and then you're empowering them. I think it demystifies a lot of what you assume of your users. The problem with that is that it doesn't necessarily lead to net new ideas and innovation. So you can use user research to spawn innovation, and it should be. So you're trying to read the context clues of the users, read between the lines, and then you say, you know, they just did this huge task. Why don't we just take them to the end of the task? Users aren't necessarily going to give you that because they are so micro-focused in the moment, and they're usually monotasked, that they'd be like, oh, if you just give me a copy and paste, I can do two or three steps forward, which is great. And if you have a backlog full of stuff that you have to get through, it's really great for prioritizing the backlog, but it's not super great for innovation and those moments that you might have incremental value or incremental innovation. Good question. Another question. I don't know. Well, it depends. So with the survey and how you're distributing the survey. So if you are distributing the survey via email, one, you have to get their permission. So usually we do it after every single time that we're with our design partners. So we partner with particular clients who are awesome, and we know that they give good feedback originally, and then, or they have really interesting cases, like use cases. So we partner with them, and then we say, oh, okay, we're going to send you a survey. So that's how you get around it, but there's a law. That's why. If you serve anything via email, there's CAN spam in the U.S., and in Europe, there's another law. But basically, people have to be opted into email to get the email about that. There's some nuances. You could technically say that your survey is about transactional relationship. If you're a SaaS company, it's transactional, but if you're more like a B2C, then it gets fuzzy gray. And so the users that I would pick are usually those people who are in my target market. So because I've done the research and I've done the planning, I say, who's my target market? Okay, great, let me find all those people. And then you ask qualitative questions at the beginning or qualifying. You have pre-screener questions that basically say, should this person be able to give you information? So if you're only looking for, you know, would-be mothers, you don't want people who have already been a mother. You want would-be mothers. You ask a question at the beginning that says, do you have a child? And then that would screen out all the people that you don't want to talk to. So typically, that's how I do it in the survey. I start with, who are my target market? Okay, let's design some pre-screener questions in order to get to it. And then if it's an existing relationship due to CAN spam laws, then I might be able to do that. Or if I have a listserv that I can already access. Good question. Next, and I'll go back there. It does. Yes, time of day is a factor. It's a hard one to compute. One, because there's so many time zones. A lot of times when I'm doing interviews like this, I'm doing more qualitative. One, if I'm present, I'll be there. So I can kind of gauge the energy in the room. I'll be like, okay, this dude clearly had a burrito and he's falling asleep. Let's try to liven him up. I usually ask them when's the best time. Or if I have specific tasks that I'm going to ask them to do, like for instance, we just did a reporting one, I ask them, when are you usually doing your reporting? My guess in the U.S. is Monday mornings. It might be Sunday morning here, which is also another loophole for us because it's like you start on Sunday. That always throws me for a loop because I clearly think it's Tuesday right now, but it's not. But that's where I would ask in the survey, like, or wherever you're finding in the pre-screener. It's like, when would be a best time for you? I'm very much like, whenever it's good time for the client, I let them kind of pick, and then we go from there. Because if you box it in too much, it gets too finicky, and then they'll flake because it's not a good time for them. So I really ask them to, like, you pick the time, and I'll make myself available, which sometimes is very late at night. And then I get a little loopy. Okay, back there in the yellow. Yeah. So user research is really great at the beginning because those are your high-risk items and you're fairly uncertain about it. So I usually say it's very at the beginning. It's like a lot of discovery stuff. So you have your discovery phase, and then you go into your definition phase. You might have some concepts, too, that you're testing. And then it kind of waves in and out. So, like, once you go to concept testing, when you do concept testing, there's a user research term that's called cognitive walkthrough. And then the user researcher will take the user through the concept, and they'll say, what are you looking at? Okay. And then it's like, imagine that I'm blind. What am I looking at? Okay, I'm looking at this. And then you ask the person to read aloud their thoughts. That's really cool because you understand if they're understanding what you put into the concept. So you can validate whether or not your concept is really good, or if they find certain things. Usability testing is done usually right before launch, and that's like on a more functioning prototype. So usability testing, I like it, but it's only going to get you the low-hanging fruit, because let's be honest, nobody's going to go back and redo a design at that point if you didn't do the user research. So, like, user research is at the beginning, you do, like, more concept testing in the middle, then you have usability, which is right before launch, but you might even do usability testing after launch, hopefully before. But those are usually the life cycles that I see. And then you might do more testing towards the end, which is multivariate, A-B testing, where you're actually putting out two concepts and then you're seeing which one works. But you only do that with really small things because a whole product might not be A-B test because it's too expensive. Does that answer your question? Is that good? Okay. That's a good question. Yes, they do lie still. Because I've tested on our own teams quite a bit at Kitchu, and then I have to call them out on it. I'd be like, is that really it? Like, come on. You're like, I've heard you in the kitchen before. So I'm a little bit more forthright when I interview our internal teams. But I still go through the same thing. I'll even our managed services team, they work on the platform and day in and day out, and they're a great resource to go and test things. But they also have bias because the other thing that happens is that there are new users, there are existing users. That's like a whole different bias bag that you have to equate for. So you say, like, a new user is usually going to give you really good insights about cognition and walkthrough, or if somebody's seeing something for the first time, you'll get good stuff there. If you ask somebody who's been on the platform for a long time, it's usually not as great because they have a bias towards the platform already. They have a propensity, like, I like things a certain way. So if you're showing them a new way, there's a bias that I don't want to change my behavior. Please don't change this feature, because I've learned it. So that'll come up too. But as far as internally, that's what you should be aware of. Like, if you do new versus old, that's a better way. And so if new people come into the company and you want to get their feedback, that's like, go for them. People who are typically in the US, account managers or customer success, we have a high turnover rate for them. And so, like, it's a constant bag of new users that I can go pick their brain. That's always good. Anybody else or no? Oh, no. Talis. Oh, that guy. Yeah. That's a very good question. Yeah. I think it's a little bit, so there's that we would call that like intercepts. So there's like guerrilla user testing. You'll hear that term, and it basically means like the surprise and delight. Like I'm going to pull people off the street and ask them. Generally, any feedback is good feedback, but the more that you can kind of prepare in advance for that, or you can prep them for the stuff, you're always going to get a little bit better of results. Versus the gorilla. What's nice about the gorilla is you do have the element of surprise, so you can usually get their feedback right away and be like, oh, you know. I find gorilla is really good for small things. Like if you're testing interaction design and you're saying like, oh, it's a slow animation versus top versus bottom versus slide pane, like if you want to get that stuff, like it's great to just quickly prototype something like a paper prototype and then go pull people off the street. Or you can even do it on your site now. There are really cool products that will actually intercept while somebody's in the flow. What you need to be cautious of is they're in the flow. Like, they're in the zone, man. And if you take them out of the zone, they might be really peeved. So usually you'll do it after. Like, once they go through the flow right away, you can pop up and say, hey, I just noticed that you completed this. Would you like to test something new, like a new flow for this? Just make sure that you do it after. That's kind of my words of advice. We don't do a lot of that at Kenshu because it's logistically very interesting. It's like, hey, do you use a B2B marketing platform? great. Could you sit down? That's a little bit hard to construct. Great questions. I hope it was super interesting. And I'll be out there if you want to come talk to me. Cool.